listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Today's broadcast is in memory of Cynthia Dove. A House Divided by James Reginato. The Mellon dynasty has long been known for its old money refinement and discretion. But when Tim Mellon became Donald Trump's biggest donor, many members of the family were mystified and not afraid to talk about it. Opening photo, Land of the Free. The main residence, dubbed the Brick House, on Paul and Rachel Bunny Mellon's former Virginia estate, Oak Spring. And the listener should be aware that this article went to press before the November elections. Think of the Brady Bunch, a member of the Mellon dynasty recently told me, as he tried to explain some family dynamics. Though 70s kitsch could hardly be further from the great banking and industrial fortune, the relative was referring to Paul Mellon and his blended family. But instead of Alice the housekeeper, more than 100 staff members were on duty at Oak Spring, a 4,500-acre estate where the walls were adorned with masterpieces by Van Gogh, Degas, and Manet. House guests included the likes of John and Jackie Kennedy, Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip, and Charles and Diana. Paul's wife, Mary, had died in 1946, leaving him with their 9-year-old daughter, Catherine, and 4-year-old son, Timothy. 2 years later, when he married Rachel Lambert Lloyd, she moved into Oak Spring with her 2 children, Eliza and Stacy III, from her marriage to Stacy Barcroft Lloyd, Jr. Bunny, as Rachel was called, became known as a paragon of refinement, understatement, and discretion. "Nothing should be noticed," she famously declared. It was an old-money credo that her stepson Tim, now 82, seemed to live by. Little ever appeared in the press about him, except for a wedding announcement in 1963, and occasional articles revolving around his interest in trains and planes. Unlike other elites with access to the levers of power, he barely engaged in politics, making only roughly $350,000 in political donations between 1996 and 2017, according to the Wall Street Journal. Then, in 2018, he sent $10 million to the Congressional Leadership Fund, the super PAC that runs ads on behalf of House GOP candidates. In the 2020 cycle, his contributions to conservative candidates and causes totaled $70 million, including $20 million to Donald Trump. And since the start of 2022, he has poured in more than $125 million to Make America Great Again, the Trump-affiliated super PAC, and $25 million to American Values 2024, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. super PAC. Tim Mellon is the most consequential mega donor of this contentious election and the least known. Next photo, planes, trains, and automobiles. Timothy Mellon in 1981 as he was expanding his railroad empire. When Tim first reached out to MAGA World to offer his largesse, they had to research him. Reportedly, he has little interest in meeting candidates or attending events, and he communicates with some by fax. Some information came to light in 2020 when the Washington Post first reported on an e-book Tim had self-published in 2015 with the oddly punctuated and cased title Pan Am Captain. It was an autobiography as well as something of a manifesto. In it, he wrote that black people became even more belligerent and unwilling to pitch in to improve their own situations after the expansion of social programs in the 1960s, and that Americans who relied on the government teat were slaves of a new master, Uncle Sam. After inquiries by the Post, the e-book was withdrawn. On July 23rd, a book with the same title was released by Skyhorse, whose founder, Tony Lyons, is also a co-founder of American Values 2024, the super PAC backing Kennedy. Lyons is also Kennedy's publisher. Apart from some reminiscences of his school days, Tim writes little about his family or his personal life. His efforts to build a railroad company and learning to fly take up most of the 171 pages. Aside from a photo of Tim as a small boy with his maternal grandparents, there are no pictures of the author. In an appendix, he reveals the itinerary of a trip in which he flew around the world, his medical history, 2008, prostate removed, and his 20 favorite movies. Number one is Casablanca. My Cousin Vinny is sixth. Via his publisher, Skyhorse, Tim Mellon declined to be interviewed for this story, but a number of Mellon family members and confidants agreed to speak. "I'm just as surprised as you are about my uncle coming out. I couldn't believe he was mentioned in the press." He's the most private Mellon there is. He's been very quiet up until now. His nephew, John W. Warner IV, told me during a phone call from his home in Virginia. One of the three children Tim's sister Kathy had with Senator John Warner, to whom she was married from 1957 to 1973, Warner IV is a military historian and former race car driver. My generation, and the younger generation, is unhappy about his very public support of what we think of as anti-democratic causes and candidates, says a cousin of Warner IV. Again and again I've heard dismay about him going in this direction. One of the cousins said it just makes her sick. Next photo, Silver Circle. Lady Bird Johnson with Paul and Bunny Mellon at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. A highly private individual, according to some who know him, Tim Mellon divides his time between his vast properties in Wyoming and Connecticut. He's had three wives and four weddings, but no children. He's socially awkward and wears old aviator glasses with tape on the bridge. He is apparently fond of Patsy Cline, has a fascination with Amelia Earhart, and an obsession with a medieval Norwegian church. His early philanthropic giving suggests that he once had some liberal impulses. Unlike many other old money clans, the Mellons are still loaded. 175 years later, the Mellons have never been richer, read a headline in Forbes, which estimates that the family is currently worth more than $14 billion. They've got staying power. Of America's billionaire dynasties, only the DuPonts have had a longer run. The family fortune originated with Paul's grandfather, Tim's great-grandfather, Thomas Mellon, who arrived in western Pennsylvania from Ireland at age five in 1818. After studying law in Pittsburgh, he invested in real estate and opened a bank. With his wife, Sarah Jane Negley, the judge, as he became known, produced six sons and two daughters. Thus, the Mellon family tree has many branches. But Thomas and Sarah's sixth born, Andrew William, Paul's father, was the real empire builder. A.W., as he was known, built a colossal fortune from banking to oil to aluminum before he became Secretary of the Treasury under Presidents Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. In a recent Substack essay, Robert Reich, who served as Labor Secretary in the Clinton administration, asserted that policies pushed through by A.W. in the 1920s, cutting the estate tax by half, whittling down the top income tax rate from 73% to 25% allowed him to shift much of his fortune to his heirs tax-free, setting the stage for immense wealth and more specifically enabling his grandson Tim to bankroll the Trump campaign today. Timothy Mellon is the product of a tax system pioneered by his grandfather that allows the perpetuation of dynastic wealth and the maintenance of its political power, wrote Reich. Yet Timothy Mellon rages against only handouts that go to those born without silver spoons. Echoing A.W.'s discernible politics, to his family he was domineering, cold, and distant. Paul and his sister Ailsa did not have a happy childhood. After their parents' rancorous divorce in 1912, they were shuttled from one cheerless Pittsburgh mansion to another. With his first marriage to Mary Conover Brown, who graduated from Vassar and studied at the Sorbonne and Columbia, Paul was finally able to pursue his interest in art and psychology and break away from Pennsylvania. After traveling to Switzerland to undergo analysis with Carl Jung, the couple settled at Oak Spring, an idyllic estate in the Hunt Country of Virginia, where they began to bring up Kathy and Tim. Ailsa, who had only one child, a daughter named Audrey, with David K. E. Bruce, also became a resident of Virginia as well as New York. But tragedy struck in 1946 when Mary, 41, died of an asthma attack. The trauma of Mary's death overshadowed my life for some time, Paul wrote in his 1992 memoir, Reflections in a Silver Spoon. I remained in a state of shock. Tim and Catherine adored their mother. He never got over losing her, a cousin told me. Next photo, Parisian persuasion. Former First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy visits Paris with Bunny in the late 1960s. Uniting his family with Bunny's at Oak Spring proved difficult. Neither Paul nor Bunny were skilled parents, and the four children had very different personalities. Dinners were strained. A number of sources recall a precious 18th-century porcelain cabbage that sat in the middle of the table. Tim, they said, would often reach over it to grab something, leading an irritated Bunny to snap at him for fear he would break the cabbage. As a little boy, he was very gregarious. In time, he became brilliantly mathematically minded, Bunny observed, adding, he has confidence, but not curiosity to branch out, according to Burton Hirsch in The Mellon Family, 1978. In the same book, she noted that Tim's political and social mindset, so different from Paul's, started emerging during adolescence to the alarm of his father. If Tim had a radical idea, Paul pounced on it. Oh, you'll learn better. You'd better change, Bunny recalled to the historian. The problem was, Tim was already rich, being the beneficiary of $100 million trust instruments and other bequests from his grandfather, according to Hirsch's book. It's hard with children who are on the same economic level. They simply don't have to listen, Bunny lamented. Tim made his feelings about his stepmother plain when he declined to discuss her with Hirsch. I hope you don't want to open that can of worms, he said. According to I'll Build a Stairway to Paradise, Matt Griswold's recent biography of Bunny, Paul agreed with Bunny that Tim was a very difficult child. Boarding school offered one solution. At age 10, Tim was enrolled at Finn, near Boston, then continued his education at Milton Academy and Yale. Before his freshman year of college, he proposed to his girlfriend, Susan Tracy. Though Sue had good credentials, bring a Bryn Mawr girl and the daughter of the president of Esso Standard Oil, Bunny tried to nix the wedding. According to Hirsch's book, Sue wasn't very deferential to Bunny. At the end of Tim's junior year, the couple went out and got married. After graduation, they moved into a simple house in Guilford, Connecticut. In the early 1970s, she helped him determine where his foundation, the Sachem Fund, should make donations. Recipients included the ACLU and a feminist law firm. They also helped finance an inquiry into poor housing conditions on Navajo reservations and a campaign to rebuild a hospital in North Vietnam. For 3 years, Tim worked with the Yale Computer Center before he opened a business that developed systems programs for small computers for educational institutions. He's a quaint introvert with a very smart analytical mind, according to one of his relatives. In the early 1980s, a company he founded, Guilford Transportation Industries, began buying up rail lines from Maine to Maryland, building a 3,900-mile railroad empire that would dominate New England freight traffic. In the years to come, Tim maintained limited contact with family. In the penultimate paragraph of Hirsch's book, a quote from Tim is portentous and rather chilling. "My view of families is that they're an anachronism. The family unit is not a functioning entity anymore. It no longer serves an economic need. I suppose it's interesting as a social phenomenon." Tim is not the first far-right moneybag in the family. In the 1990s, Richard Mellon Skyff became the principal funder of the vast right-wing conspiracy against Bill Clinton. Skyff was a grandson of A.W.'s younger brother, Dick. The lion's share of Mellons still lives in Pennsylvania. Many of them are Republicans, according to Warner IV, as was Paul during his lifetime. He died in 1999, even as Bunny, a fervent Democrat, became intimate with the Kennedys. "You want to know where the Mellon enclave is? It's in Ligonier," says Warren IV, referring to the lush, rolling hills about an hour southeast of Pittsburgh. The Ligonier crowd, as he calls them, is a mixture of conservative and liberal and everything in between. One of those is Christopher Mellon, who is descended from the judge's second son, James. Christopher served as a deputy assistant secretary of defense for intelligence in the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. Recently, he made headlines when he joined a small group of former officials with security clearances who came forward to reveal secret government studies of UFOs and to sound the alarm about the security threat they pose. "He and I share the UFO extraterrestrial involvement issue," Warner IV says about his third cousin. "He's on the ultra-conservative side, and I take the moderate side. You know, we're not alone. Big deal. The big deal is that the military-industrial corporate intelligence complex has been hiding the possibilities of what's going on out there." Most members of the AW branch are based in the Virginia, D.C. area, and almost all of them are Democrats. They also seem to think of themselves as the true royalty of the Klan, as one member phrased it to me. This branch includes Ailsa's grandchildren, the children of her only child, Audrey, and Audrey's husband, Stephen Currier, himself related by marriage to the immensely wealthy Warburg family. In 1967, the couple, both civil rights activists, disappeared in a mysterious private plane crash. The wreckage was never found. Orphaning, Andrea, 10, Lavinia, 9, and Michael, 5. With their inheritances from Ailsa, who died in 1969, Mrs. Ailsa Mellon Bruce Dead, called richest woman in the U.S., read the headline of her obituary in the New York Times, and the Warburgs, the Currier children became possibly the wealthiest of the Mellon scions. Harvard-educated Lavinia, an environmentalist and filmmaker, is very involved with Tibet issues and has a close relationship with the Dalai Lama. When I interviewed her about one of her films in the late 1990s, she expressed horror over the activities of Richard Mellon Skyff. "For a liberal Democrat like myself, I'm embarrassed to be a melon right now, with this fellow running around. The Pennsylvanians and the Virginians rarely meet. Matthew Mellon, a younger brother of Christopher, was until recently the highest profile melon, given his flashy lifestyle with his first wife, Jimmy Choo co-founder Tamara Yeardai, his cryptocurrency advocacy, and his battles with drug use. Nobody recognized him when he appeared at the funeral service for Eliza, Tim's stepsister, in 2008. He just showed up. He wasn't invited, a Virginia Mellon recounts. He comes up to me, "Hey, it's so great to be here for the family." I'm like, "Who are you?" Matthew died in Cancun in 2018. In the early 1980s, following his divorce from Sue, Tim married Louise Whitney, an Upperville, Virginia native who had been a childhood friend. After she and Tim divorced in the early 1990s, Tim married Patricia Trenary Freeman, who was recently divorced from Charles Chas Freeman, Jr., a classmate of Tim's at Milton and Yale, as well as best man at his first wedding. Chas, a diplomat, gave an interview around 1995 in which he said, "I had quite a happy marriage of 30 years with her, which broke up in the summer of 1992 in a very nasty way." Tim and Patricia, who had three children with Chas, later divorced and then remarried. In an email to me, Ambassador Freeman commented, "Tim Mellon's callous betrayal of our friendship was almost as hurtful as my then-wife's abandonment of me for reasons she declined to explain." In 1998, Tim purchased brand rights to Pan Am Airways after it filed for bankruptcy. He rebranded his rail company Pan Am Railways. In June 2022, CSX announced it had completed the acquisition of Pan Am Railways. Terms were not disclosed. While the London Times has reported that Tim has a net worth of $1 billion, Warner the Fourth says, "I've read that he's worth $4.2 billion." He further says the combined worth of the Mellon clan today is more like $25 billion. These families don't want the public to know what they're worth. Given his uncle's wealth, his political donations are not huge outlays. It's pocket change for him, says Warner the Fourth. He must have spent a bundle on a most unusual project on his estate in Lyme, Connecticut, a bucolic area where colonial-era saltbox houses are the norm. Tim's property encompasses hundreds of acres, but passers-by on a small road have been astonished to see an exact replica of a Norwegian stave church dating to the 12th or 13th century. Toward the end of the Viking period, when Norway became a Christian country, numerous stave churches were built. The wooden structures feature a series of roofs, each one offset and becoming smaller as the church reaches toward the sky. Marvels of engineering, they require an intricate system of beams and pillars. Tim decided he wanted a full-scale replica of the stave church in Borgund, Norway, which is considered the finest of the genre, erected on his property. After many reconnaissance trips to Norway, a team of skilled workmen spent years painstakingly recreating it in lime. "It was an obsession of his. It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen," I was told by one of the apparently very few people who has seen it up close. "He doesn't want anyone to see it." I know people who have gone down that road to look at it, and he's chased them out of there, a local told me. In the majestic but sparsely populated south of Wyoming, where Tim bought a vast ranch in 2005, he suffers no interlopers. "I can think of no place on earth more quiet and peaceful and conducive to easy concentration," he writes in Panam.Captain. In his golden years, Tim has the wherewithal to finance passion projects. In 2012, he donated stock valued at more than $1 million to the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery to help finance their search for the remains of Amelia Earhart's plane. After the expedition failed to find the wreckage, Tim located video footage that he said revealed the debris. Claiming that the organization did not act on this evidence, he sued it for fraud and other claims. The suit, which dragged on for 2 years, was eventually dismissed. A happier outcome seems to be on the horizon in Winchester, Virginia, where in 2016, Tim donated property to develop a park adjacent to the home of Patsy Cline, now a museum. The project is slated for completion this year. Relatives and Mellon family friends I spoke to are puzzled, as well as disturbed, by how far to the right Tim has lurched. He's always been a contrarian. That's the only thing I can think of that might have gotten him in this direction, which does not reflect our values, says a cousin. He's always just been one of those guys who's gone to the beat of his own drum and operated very quietly, says a member of the younger generation. Paul, this person said, would be aghast at the Trumpification of the Republican Party and his son's support for it. He'd be appalled. I think Paul would be vocally upset at Tim. I remember him being a lovely, nice man, a friend of Bunny's says about Tim. I just don't know how he got involved with such kooky extremism, because he wasn't brought up in that kind of environment. I don't know who he listens to, but he should be smarter. Even for him, this is outrageous. Bunny would be very appalled. He was into Rush Limbaugh, says Warner the Fourth. My mother told me she was furious about that. She told him, "You idiot. Why are you listening to that idiot?" Tim's like, "I like it. I'm the only libertarian, and Tim is the only Republican," Warner the Fourth continues. Tim and Kathy aren't particularly close, he says. They talk maybe twice a year, but they're friendly. She was a hippie type. She still is at 87. They're polar opposites. Warner the Fourth's comments speak to a time when people on different sides of the aisle engaged before the right went so far to the right. It killed my dad at the end of his life. He was just so sad about what happened at the Senate. He had a lot of Democratic friends. He was a middle-of-the-road, moderate Republican. Parts of me are conflicted because he's been very nice to me, but I'd love to sort of dig through his mind to figure out how he is supporting these people and disrupting the system, says a younger member of the family. I honestly think a lot of it has to do with how Trump brought down the barriers of decency. It got to the point where these people are like, if we don't support him, there's nobody else we can support at this stage. We can't support a Democrat. In his mind, and with others like him, they have lived very much independently of the government system. They don't really need to have a relationship with most Americans. The way I see it, Tim is just not a very social person. He's not integrated himself with a lot of community. I guarantee you, he's not one of those people who likes Trump's character. He probably thinks he's an asshole. I think what it comes down to is he wants to be left alone, and he wants no one to tax him. It's that libertarian viewpoint that's become radicalized. There are a lot of really rich people out there who just don't need to think about what's best for America anymore. It's just setting aside the interest of a lot of people for yourself. Why is he doing this? Bunny's friend exclaims. People say, oh, you know, taxes. Well, what does he care? He doesn't have any children. He could never spend all the money he has. It's just crazy. Tim is a stepfather to Pat Freeman's 3 children. In the end, Tim remains inscrutable to many. He doesn't communicate with us. Last time I saw him was at Bunny's funeral, says Warner the Fourth. Bunny did leave a bequest to her stepson. Just one thing, the porcelain cabbage. It was her way of saying, here's your porcelain cabbage, says a relative. Now don't break it. Given Tim's political donations, the younger Mellons I spoke to fear not just for American democracy, but for their family legacy. As one of them put it, we generally come to our politics and philanthropy with a sense of compassion for other people. The MAGA folks and the causes that Tim is supporting are completely lacking in compassion. That's not the way we want to be remembered. A lost cause. When a school board in South Carolina erupted over efforts to ban his book Between the World and Me, Ta-Nehisi Coates went to listen in on the fight. Here, an excerpt from the message, with illustrations by Yannick Lowry. Opening illustration shows, in the summer of 1920 in Duluth, Minnesota, a white mob lynched Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee. This article is from The Message by Ta-Nehisi Coates, copyright 2024 by BCP Literary Incorporated, published by One World, an imprint of Random House, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC, all rights reserved. And here's a quote from Mark Oliver. The only book learning we ever got was when we stole it. Master bought some slaves from Cincinnati that had worked in white folks' houses. They had stole a little learning, and when they came to our place, they passed on to us what they knew. We wasn't allowed no paper and pencil. I learned all my ABCs without it. I knows how to read, and ain't never been in a schoolroom in my life. There was one woman by the name of Aunt Sylvia. She was so smart, she foreknowed things before they took place. The summer of 2020 now feels like distant history, and it is easy to be cynical about that moment, given the backlash that has followed that season of protest over the parade of Americans murdered by the forces we pay to protect us. But I remember an even more distant era, when the names of those killed died with the people who carried them. Those 2020 protests succeeded in implanting some skepticism in people who were raised on the idea of officer friendly. I think that is what the white supremacist feared most, the spreading realization that the cops were not knights, and the creeping sense among Americans that there was something rotten, not just in law enforcement, but maybe also in the law itself. That fear explains the violence of the response to the protest, but even that violence redounded to the benefit of the protesters because it confirmed their critique. What was the justifiably noble interest that required tear-gassing protesters blocks from the Capitol, or the deployment of secret police in Portland, or the literal cracking of heads in Buffalo? While violence was never forsworn, by the end of summer, white supremacists had learned a lesson. The war might be raging in the streets, but it could never be defeated there, because what they were ultimately fighting was the word. Around the same time George Floyd was killed, Nicole Hannah Jones won a Pulitzer Prize for her lead essay in the 1619 Project, which argued for America's origins not in the Declaration of Independence, but in enslavement. Nicole is my homegirl, and like me, she believes that journalism, history, and literature have a place of honor in our fight to make a better world. I had the great fortune of watching her build the 1619 Project, of being on the receiving end of text with highlighted pages from history books, of hearing her speak on the thrilling experience of telling our story, some 400 years after we arrived here, in all the grandeur it deserved. Seeing the seriousness of effort, her passion for it, the platform she commanded, and the response it garnered, I knew a backlash was certain to come, but I can't say I understood how profound this backlash would be, that a 1776 project would be initiated by the president, that the 2020 protest would be dubbed by some on the right as the 1619 riots, thus explicitly, if in bad faith, connecting the writing and the street, and that the White House would issue Executive Order 13950, targeting any education or training that included the notion that America was fundamentally racist. The idea that any race bore responsibility for actions committed in the past, or any other divisive concept that should provoke discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress on account of his or her race. It's true that the order was revoked after its author lost the next election, but by that time it had spawned a suite of state-level variants. Laws, policies, directives, and resolutions, all erected to excise divisive concepts from any training or education. The flag of parental rights was raised. In Tennessee and Georgia, teachers were fired. School boards in Virginia were besieged, and in North Carolina, Nicole's tenure at the state's flagship university, where she herself was an alum, was denied. I guess it's worth pointing out the obvious, that the very governors and politicians who loudly exalt the values of free speech are among the most aggressive prosecutors of divisive concepts. And I guess it should be noted that what these politicians, and even some writers, dubbed critical race theory bore little resemblance to that theory's actual study and practice. So I will note it. But the simple fact is that these people were liars, and to take them seriously, to press a case of hypocrisy or misreading, is to be distracted again. The goal, as their most prominent activist helpfully explained, is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and think critical race theory. It worked. Today, some 4 years after the signing of 13950, nearly half the country's school children have been protected by the state from critical race theory and other divisive concepts. It may seem strange that a fight that began in the streets has now moved to the library, that a counter-revolution in defense of brutal policing has now transformed itself into a war over scholarship and art. But in the months after George Floyd's murder, books by black authors on race and racism shot to the top of bestseller and most borrowed list. Black bookstores saw their sales skyrocket. The cause for this spike was, in the main, people who had been exposed to the image of George Floyd being murdered, who suddenly began to suspect that they had not been taught the entire truth about justice, history, policing, racism, and any number of other related subjects. The spike only lasted that summer, but it was enough to leave the executors of 13950 shook, and they were right to be. History is not inert, but contains within it a story that implicates the present. And framed a certain way, a story can be told that justifies the present political order. A political order is not just premised on who can vote, but on what they can vote for, which is to say, on what unrealized possibilities can be imagined. Our possibilities are defined by our history, our culture, and our myths. That the country's major magazines, newspapers, publishing houses, and social media were suddenly lending space to stories that questioned the agreed-upon narrative meant that it was possible that Americans as a whole might begin to question them too, and a new narrative and a new set of possibilities might then be born. The truth is that even as I know and teach the power of writing, I still find myself in disbelief when I see that power at work in the real world. Maybe it is the nature of books. Film, music, the theater, all can be experienced amidst the whooping, clapping, and cheering of the crowd. But books work when no one else is looking, mind-melding author and audience, forging an imagined world that only the reader can see. Their power is so intimate, so insidious, that even its authors don't always comprehend it. I see politicians in Colorado, in Tennessee, in South Carolina, moving against my own work, tossing books I've authored out of libraries, banning them from classes, and I feel snatched out of the present and brought into another age, one of pitchforks and book-burning bonfires. My first instinct is to laugh, but then I remember that American history is filled with men and women as lethal as they were ridiculous, and when I force myself to take a serious look, I see something familiar, an attempt by adults to break the young minds entrusted to them and remake them in a more orderly and pliable form. What these adults are ultimately seeking is not simply the reinstatement of their preferred dates and interpretations, but the preservation of a whole manner of learning, austere and authoritarian, that privileges the indoctrination of national dogmas over the questioning of them. The danger we present as writers is not that we will simply convince their children of a different dogma, but that we will convince them that they have the power to form their own. I know this directly. I imagine my books to be my children, each with its own profile and way of walking through the world. My eldest, the beautiful struggle, is the honorable, hardworking son. He has that union job my father once aspired to, 4 kids, and a wife he met in high school. My second son, between the world and me, is the gifted one, or rather the one whose gifts are most easily translated to the rest of the world. He plays in the NBA, enjoys the finer things, and talks more than he should. I see we were 8 years in power as the insecure one, born in the shadow of my gifted son, and who has never quite gotten over it. He has problems. We don't talk about him much. All these children suspect that my daughter, my baby girl, the water dancer, is my favorite. Perhaps. She certainly is the one that is most like me, if a little better, more confident, and more self-assured. I see my books this way because it helps me remember that though they are made by me, they are not ultimately mine. They leave home, travel, have their own relationships, and leave their own impressions. I've learned it's best to, as much as possible, stay out of the way and let them live their own lives. My loyalty to that lesson is dispositional. I am often struck by secondhand embarrassment watching writers defend themselves against every bad review. But it's also strategic. My work is to set the table, craft the argument, render the world as I imagine it, and then leave. Some people will like it, others won't, and nothing can change that. I am at my worst out there defending my children, and at my best out of the public eye, enjoying the pleasure of making more of them. But in the months after George Floyd, it became clear that this was a privilege. Out in the real world, teachers, parents, students, and librarians saw in this man's murder an America they had not previously known. And with this new knowledge of the world, there came an urge to understand. When these people spoke out, they found their livelihoods imperiled. They did not have the luxury of declining to defend themselves. I think a lot about this one note I received from Woodland Park, Colorado. The school board was trying to ban Between the World and Me. A resident wrote urging me to reach out to one of the teachers who was fighting it. He believes in you and your message, as do I, the resident wrote, and he has been suffering for it. Suffering. It felt inhuman to let that pass, so I sent along a note of support. I even went on TV to call out the school board, but after that, I retreated into my own private space of bookmaking. Next illustration. Homes and businesses smoke after the Tulsa Race Massacre, June 1921. Protesters hold pictures of George Floyd at a Juneteenth rally in Brooklyn, 2020, and Indigenous warrior Medicine Owl, circa 1920. And then I read about Mary Wood. The outlines of the case were not much different from others I'd heard about. She was a teacher in South Carolina, who had been forced to drop Between the World and Me from her lesson plan because it made some of her students, in their words, feel uncomfortable and ashamed to be Caucasian. Moreover, they were sure that the very subject of the book, systemic racism, was illegal. These complaints bore an incredible resemblance to the language of 13950, which prohibited divisive concepts that provoked in students discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress on account of his or her race or sex. And it was not just the students' complaints that resembled the executive order. The South Carolina 2022 budget contained a prohibition lifted nearly word for word from 13950. The connection between the legislation and 13950 was obvious. Still, for the first time, I began to think about the vocabulary being employed: discomfort, shame, anguish, and how it read like a caricature of the vocabulary of safety that had become popular on campuses around the country. I suspect this was intentional. Oppressive power is preserved in the smoke and fog, and sometimes it is smuggled in the unexamined shadows of the language of the oppressed themselves. The strategy banks on the limited amount of time possessed by most readers and listeners and aims to communicate via shorthand that is just as often sleight of hand. It's not surprising that everyday people grappling with laundry, PTA meetings, and bills do not always see the device and the deception. But the difference is clear. Mary's protesting students were not looking to attach a warning to Between the World and Me about its disturbing imagery or themes, but to have the book, by force of law, removed from the state's school altogether. Literature is anguish. Even small children know this. I was no older than 5, crying in the back seat of my parents' orange Volkswagen while they argued up front. When they turned to comfort me, they were shocked to learn that I was crying not about their argument, but about the grasshopper who starved in winter while the ant feasted. The wolf devours Grandma. The gingham dog and the calico cat devour each other. I was not born into a religious home, but I knew that my peers had been raised on stories of God casting Adam and Eve from paradise for biting an apple, that he had destroyed all life save that contained in the ark on a whim, that he had condemned me and every other non-believer to eternal suffering. I suspect these believers would say that the anguish, this discomfort, radiating out of their own gospel, is not incidental, but is at the heart of its transformative power. For my part, the anguish of the story of the grasshopper and the ant was in the moral of the story, that laziness and foolishness made one worthy of starvation. This kind of retribution left me empty, and even then I felt I wanted no part of a world that called starvation just. That was my personal revelation, and one that apparently ran contrary to the story's intended message. But in my anguish, in my disagreement with the core of the text, I found my truth. And that, I suspect, is the real problem. Whatever the attempt to ape the language of college students, it is neither anguish nor discomfort that these people were trying to prohibit. It was enlightenment. I tracked down Mary's number. We spoke for about a half an hour. She talked about the whole ordeal, the paranoia incited by anonymous complaints, the school board meetings where she was pilloried, the threats to her job. She spoke of the conservative tilt of the area where she taught, Chapin, South Carolina, a lakeside town to the northwest of the state capital of Columbia. She spoke of her own enlightenment, of going off to college and reading post-colonial literature until she felt the puzzle pieces of the world locking into place. She talked of George Floyd's murder and how she'd formed a book group with her department in that watershed summer. That was how she found Between the World and Me. We were the same age. We both had children who drove us crazy. We both practiced yoga for sanity. And she needed it now more than ever. All this she said in an accent that told me that she was not just from some place, but of that some place. I have an accent just like that, remarkable as a facial scar. And there was something else just as remarkable. Mary didn't teach civics or current events. She taught writing, advanced placement language and composition, to be precise. For the exam, students would have to write an argumentative essay themselves, and to help them learn how, she'd called upon Between the World and Me, my loud and boisterous second son. Perhaps I am straining the metaphor, but I really did feel like one of my children had gone and gotten someone else into trouble. "What will you do next year?" I asked Mary toward the end of our phone call. "I'm going to finish the lesson I started," she said. "I'm going to teach Between the World and Me." I sat on the phone, silent, for 8 seconds. Writing is all process to me, not finished work. It begins in the kind of anguish South Carolina sought to forbid, sometimes originating in something I've read, but more often in the world itself, in peoples and systems whose declared aims run contrary to their actions. And through reading, through reporting, I begin to comprehend a truth. That moment of comprehension is ecstatic. Writing and rewriting is the attempt to communicate not just a truth, but the ecstasy of a truth. It is not enough for me to convince the reader of my argument. I want them to feel that same private joy that I feel. When I go out in the world, it's gratifying to hear that people have shared part of that joy. But Mary didn't just enjoy reading the book. The book had brought her into the fight. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman. Today's broadcast is in memory of Cynthia Dove.